and welcome to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Craig Couch, and every week it's my job to interview top performers and unlock the secrets of their success so that you and I can apply some of their thought patterns, daily rituals, and strategies to our own missions. My next guest is Bill Craftson. Bill is a well-known apologist and has been the last several decades helping people discover the meaning of life. He uses the open forum platform to give room and safety for the questioners of God's existence. For over 45 years, Bill has enjoyed the privilege of facilitating hundreds of large and small group discussions, as well as interacting with countless individuals on the life and God issues that matter most to all of us. Questions like, if there's a loving God, why would he let bad things happen to good people? Or what about the intolerance and hypocrisy of religion? And how good does one have to be to get to heaven? He loves the close personal relationships that frequently emerge from these vigorous but respectful intellectual exchanges. Bill earned a bachelor's from Wheaton College back in 1970. He's a graduate of the Dallas Theological Seminary in 1974. And in 1977, he helped found Search, a non-profit dedicated to creating safe environments for addressing these big questions. And he's lived here in Fort Worth with his wife, Janet, since 1974, and they have three grown married children and six grandchildren. That's so awesome. Bill, welcome to the True Grit Podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, well, today's show is going to be a fun conversation with some super tough questions, but before we dive in, one of your friends told me that you are one heck of an athlete. Tell me about your soccer career.
Boy, this is a relative term. Somebody says if they hear you play a sport, sometimes I was into racquetball years ago before my back got injured. And somebody said, how good are you? And I said, well, compared to what? So, in a average size fish in a small pond, but it is all relative. All I can say, I'm sort of a jock of many sports, master of none. And the one exception to that would be to where I'm, you know, okay at a lot of different things, not great at it. But the one exception to that is golf. Have not figured out any athleticism that I have, haven't figured out how to apply it to golf. So,
well, I played golf in college, played golf in high school. My son plays college golf. I played golf in high school, and then when I got to college, it was so expensive to play, I just stopped and didn't pick up the club again until my son was about 8 or 9 years old. And so we played together until he was 18 or so, and then he went off to play college golf. And but I didn't continue to play. I just started carrying his bag and caddying for him because I see golf as a good way to frustrate a pretty walk in a park.
a lot of great lines about that. Yeah, all I can say about sports is I've just had a lot of pleasure, a lot of fun over the years, and a lot of relationships I found out come through sports. So
for sure. So how do you stay so fit nowadays? I mean, you're lean and fit as a fiddle.
A pretty helpful metabolism. Work out a few times a week. Still play a little bit of basketball, and just try to watch the intake.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Well, so I'm really curious. You know, there's lots of different ministries out there and lots of different ways to make a difference in the world. Why apologetics for you?
Well, for me, it goes all the way back to my high school growing up years. I grew up in a wonderful, faith-filled home, just really privileged in all the best senses of the word. And yet, in spite of the fact that I saw Christianity lived out beautifully by my parents, I started having intellectual doubts when I was in high school. And in our circles, I didn't hear anybody else asking those questions. And I kind of wondered, what's wrong with me that I have these doubts? And then the other part of it that was disturbing is, what if there aren't answers to these questions? How do we know this is true? So this goes back a long ways for me. I don't know where the questions came from. I wasn't rebelling. I had nothing to rebel against. And it took me a couple years to come to the point that I was satisfied on intellectual grounds that what I call the central truth claims of Christianity are actually valid. Once I became satisfied, now by the way, I'm going to be continuing to learn the rest of my life. I don't mean that I got all the answers then. But once I became satisfied that the central truth claims of Christianity were valid, it was about at the time, it converged at a time in my life, say beginning of college years, where I'm thinking about what I want to do with my life. I want to do something meaningful. Well, if this is true, there's nothing in the world that compares in importance to the whole, some of these big questions about a relationship with God and eternity and what happens when we die. And if the claims of Christ are true, we've got some profound answers to these big questions. And so it starts out because they're my questions. And then I come to realize that I'm not the only one who's asking these questions, that just about everybody thinks about these questions. So I went to graduate school, not knowing what direction this was going to take, not having a clue. And a speaker came in and talked about some groups that he was starting to form with some of his colleagues. He was a lawyer, where they just got together in groups, no Bibles, no prayer, took a lot of those intimidating elements out of there, and just welcomed people to put their questions on the table and discuss them in a respectful and open kind of conversation. And as soon as I heard about it, something just clicked, and I just thought, that just sounds perfect, because they're going to be wrestling with the same questions that I've wrestled with. They're discussing what I think are the most important things in the world. That's what I want to be doing. And so I talked to some people I knew and asked them if they had some friends that they'd like to invite. And they were crazy enough or brave enough that they did that. And so that was many, many years ago. And as you mentioned in the introduction, I've had the privilege of facilitating hundreds of those discussion groups, which could be from 20 to 100 people. But then what I love is the opportunity for individual conversations with people over lunch or a cup of coffee, and really hearing what people's questions are and hearing their opinions and being able to interact about them.
How did the people respond in your earlier years, kind of before you chose this path? The way you described it, you were kind of naturally inquisitive. And when you start asking hard questions around some people, I just wonder how they responded to your inquisitive attitude towards God.
Well, I think if somebody is a committed believer, that doesn't mean that they're not aware that these questions are out there. In fact, I think just about everybody at some level deals with some of these questions. But if somebody's a committed believer, the fact that somebody's willing to tee it up, I think there's generally a sense of appreciation about that, that you mean we don't have to run and hide from these questions? And then, of course, for people who are asking the questions, and they're not sure if any of this is true, well, then, of course, it's pretty encouraging to find a welcome atmosphere where you ask a question and you say, hey, I think, believing in God is just a psychological crutch, or the Bible's just a collection of fairy tales. And rather than getting upset about it, we thank them for the questions. Exactly. That's what we're here to talk about. Thanks for bringing it up. And so I don't know. I think if you love the questions and you welcome the questions, I think it ends up being kind of uplifting.
Well, I have a wide variety of people that listen to this podcast, and I reached out to a lot of them and told them that we were going to be talking today, and kind of gave them a little bit a brief background on you, and asked them to submit some questions to me, and I got a big pile of them here. Won't be able to get to all of them, but I'd like to dive right in and just have a discussion about this. So the first one, and I'm going to leave these all anonymous because—
By the way, caveat, yeah. I don't have all the answers. I have some answers, yes, that have been, yes, enormously helpful to me personally.
For sure.
And that have occasionally been helpful to somebody else, but yeah, nobody has all the answers.
You're exactly right. And some of that is by design, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. So here is this. I'm going to start us off with a zinger. So this guy says, I see a lot of so-called Christians around town that behave terribly. If they're Christians, why don't they behave in a, quote, godly manner? You know, they have the Christian fish on their car as they cut me off and shoot me the bird on a Sunday morning while wearing church clothes. What gives, he says. I know a lot of non-Christians that are just better people than most of the Christians I know. What's the point, he says.
That's a fantastic question. It's one of, you know, over the years I've come to the conclusion there are about 10 or 12 questions, major questions. And it's kind of interesting. Almost nothing else comes up. That's one of them. And it's a huge barrier for a lot of people. There's so many things running through my mind. But one of them is hypocrisy is not uniquely a Christian problem. It's a human problem. It's widespread, whether somebody is a Christian or a Buddhist or they're Jewish or Hindu, or maybe it's somebody in politics. Pretense, pretending to be something that you're not, is a human problem. And so it exists everywhere. One of the things that really struck me a long time ago when I first heard it was somebody saying, okay, if you hate hypocrisy, one of the things that you should realize, and let's say specifically hypocrisy of Christians, is that I know of no one throughout human history who went on record who was as opposed to hypocrisy and as hostile to hypocrisy as Jesus was, and at great personal cost. He called the religious leaders of his day, he called them, one of the things he said, they're like whitewashed tombs, nice and white and painted on the outside, full of decaying and rotten flesh on the inside. Really harsh criticism. He said to those leaders, you will travel land and sea to make one convert and then turn him into twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. And of course, this fueled their fire to get rid of him. And so it'd be hard to find another figure in human history that was as opposed to hypocrisy as Jesus is. So here's the bottom line. For somebody for whom this hypocrite thing is a barrier to Christianity, why let something that you and Jesus agree on completely come between you and him? Now, I understand if you want to reject a system, Christianity, you want to reject the church, you want to reject certain Christians, I get that. But to reject Jesus, the one who took a far stronger position than any of us has ever done against hypocrisy, it just makes no sense. So there's a partial response to a very important question. And I think another piece of this is, first of all, let me acknowledge that, you know, you're your friend made the comment that there are many people that are not Christians that live better than some Christians. I agree. I think it's an undeniable fact. And whenever I think about this, I think of one particular, I have several atheist friends, but one particular, I think he lives a more principled Christian life than many Christians I know. He lives a noble life. I have tremendous respect for the way that he lives his life. And so to believe that Christianity is true doesn't mean that you think that only Christians live a good life. And one of the central messages of the Bible cover to cover is that, truth be known, there's not one of us that comes close to being what we could be and should be. Now, if somebody does become a believer in Christ, A, and B, they decide to follow him, they won't get perfect. They will get better. And so the question is, first of all, is Christianity true? And then secondly, if it is true, does it make a difference? And I think the answer to those two questions is certainly yes, but only if applied.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like you got some kind of medical problem. You go to see the doctor. Doctor says, I know exactly what that is. Take this pill. You don't take the pill and you bash the doctor and you say, you know, he ought to have his license removed. Wait a minute. You didn't take the medicine. And so are there people that claim to follow Christ and ignore what he says about how they should live their lives, how they should treat other people, how they should conduct their business? Sadly, absolutely yes. But let's not throw him under the bus because they failed to follow what he said.
Well said. Well, my next question is I like it. And it kind of points to that, to the last part of what you were saying. The question is, what does it mean to be born again anyway? The rebirth has always confused me and sounds a little silly.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It confused the person that Jesus talked to about that, Nicodemus. A religious leader who came to question Jesus. And I think, by the way, although Jesus was oftentimes questioned by religious leaders in the way that they were setting a trap for him, I think I get the sense that Nicodemus was sincerely investigating. And he comes to Jesus, and this is found in John chapter 3 in the New Testament. And Jesus pretty much right off the bat says, you know, if you want to get into the kingdom of heaven, you need to be born again. Now, that term born again kind of got beat to death to the point that it's a phrase that turns off a lot of people as though what is a born again Christian and so on and so forth. But I think as you look at the and another interesting thing, by the way, is it's not used often in the Bible. That's pretty rare usage. In fact, I think maybe the only usage of that exact term is that one place in John chapter 3. Okay, so what's the context there? So here's a guy, he's a good guy, he's a religious leader, and Jesus says, but you're not going to get into heaven unless you're born again or born from above. Nicodemus is confused, and he says, wait a minute, you go back into my mother's womb? He's just scratching his head. Jesus is using a metaphor, and he's looking at it kind of in a physical, literal sense, and scratching his head. And Jesus goes on to explain, okay, Nicodemus, you've had a physical birth. And in Nicodemus's case, he was born into a very religious household. But Nicodemus, that doesn't get you a right relationship with God. You need to be born spiritually. You need to have a spiritual birth. So Jesus talks to Nicodemus first of all about his need for this spiritual birth, and then a little bit later on, he tells them the means to the spiritual birth. And we find in that portion of John chapter 3 what is probably the best known verse in the New Testament, John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. So Nicodemus, your birth, even into this wonderful godly Jewish home, that doesn't get you a right relationship with God, sins forgiven. You need to have a spiritual birth. How do you have that spiritual birth? Jesus said, by believing in him. Nobody comes close, as I mentioned earlier, to being what we could be and what we should be. And a lot of people assume that God's going to grade on the curve and sweep all of our sins under the carpet as long as we're not really terrible. And we can all think of people we think are worse than we are. But the message of the Bible to cover is God's not going to grade on the curve. His standard is perfection. He's not going to sweep it under the carpet. But he loves us, wants a relationship with us. And Jesus came for that very purpose, to offer his life. I deserve punishment, condemnation from God when you look at the thousands, maybe millions of sins and failures in my life. God's not going to sweep it under the carpet, but he wants a relationship with me now and forever. And so he says, I'll tell you what, the punishment has to be paid. But I love you and I'm going to pay the penalty for you. And then stunningly, having accomplished that full and complete payment on the cross, he turns around and offers forgiveness as a gift that I can't earn and I don't deserve. And so fundamentally, to be born again, put all that together, means we've not only had the physical birth, but that we've admitted the truth about ourselves and accepted the pardon and the forgiveness accomplished by Jesus Christ. And so the promise is that anybody who, rather than trusting in themselves and their own goodness to gain a relationship with God, places their trust in Jesus and the payment that he made, the promise is, all right, you're now a child of God. If anybody receives him in John chapter 1, you have the right to become a child of God. So that, you know, maybe that was longer than you're looking for. What does it mean to be born again? Yeah. It's a term that I think has turned off and confused a great number of people. And that's what it comes down to, which is really, I believe, a central theme of the entire Bible.
Well, I'd like to zoom out on this next one and get a little bit more macro. And the next question is, do you believe in absolute truth? Because what's true for me might not be true for you. What say you?
Well, to say there is no such thing as absolute truth is, you know, in philosophy, it's called a self-defeating position. What about that statement?
Yeah.
So you can't make the statement that there is no absolute truth without undoing the statement. It's like saying, I cannot utter a word in English. And you say, well, you just did. The statement that someone might make, there is no such thing as absolute truth. Well, that's a statement as though that at least is absolutely true. And so I think what we're left with is, you can't say that there is no absolute truth without cutting off the branch that you're sitting on. And so I think the possibility obviously exists that, yes, there is absolute truth.
So just to kind of follow up on that idea, it just seems as though in our culture, there is this attack on truth. As you see our language and the meaning of words get fuzzy, what is the importance of this absolute truth?
Well, I think it comes down to, can we ever really know anything? And I think if somebody takes the position that all truth is relative, which again is a self-defeating statement, because if all truth is relative, so would that statement be, and it just doesn't undoes itself. Then I think what it does is, whether intentionally or not, it discourages real intellectual work and pursuit and investigation mm-hmm. and searching for the truth, because it's a way of saying there's no point in investigating because there's no truth out there to be discovered. So it's self-defeating. It's very discouraging. And I think for some people, it's an excuse. It's a way of saying, well, we'll never know, so why bother my head about all this? Why bother addressing those fundamental questions about where did I come from? What's my purpose for being here? How should I live? And what happens when I die? And so I think that attitude about there being no absolute truth and that all truth is relative really discourages honest inquiry and investigation, encourages kind of a, not only an intellectual laziness, but a moral laziness. Because if this is true, then I can not only believe whatever I want to believe, I can live however I want to live.
Yeah, pretty common. Pretty common, the intellectual laziness. It just seems as though, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but it seems as though the atheistic notion is pretty simplistic, like too simplistic, like oversimplifying some of these really tough questions, almost setting them aside. I don't know. Seems that way to me.
I can't cite you the page and chapter, but that's almost a direct quote of something that C.S. Lewis said in his famous book, Mere Christianity. The first five chapters of his book are an explanation of, and it's only about 25 pages, but it's not light reading, an explanation of what convinced him intellectually to move from decades of atheism to believe that there must be a God after all. And after those five chapters, he makes that statement. It turns out then that atheism is too simple. So I would just encourage anybody that is interested, read the first few chapters of Lewis's Mere Christianity.
Well, I have to admit, I just did a deep dive study on that over the last, I don't know, I guess it was a month ago, but it took me six weeks or so, and I did it with a bunch of buddies. So I guess that wasn't an original idea. I got it from there for sure, because I've been thinking about it. It does seem that way, and thank you for pointing that out. That's awesome.
Now, by the way, in 6 weeks, you guys did the whole book or just the first five chapters?
No, we did it. It may have taken 2 months, so it may have taken 8 weeks, I loved it. I mean, I've read it before, but I think you're right. It's an important writing for sure. I just really, really loved it.
One of the things I love in the preface, Lewis says, "Look, if you're looking for a book to tell you why you should be a Methodist versus a Catholic versus whatever," he said, "you've come to the wrong place. I have no interest. But what I'm going to try to do is explain to you why I move from atheism to believe the main things that they all have in common." So the first five chapters of his book explain what convinced him intellectually that there must be a God after all. The next five chapters, that are book two in Mere Christianity, he explains how he came from believing that there is a God to believing that Jesus is God. And then the next dozen or so chapters talk about Christian ethics and morality, and a wonderful, wonderful book, but not an easy read.
No, not at all.
I think there are more accessible things, but not many that are more insightful.
So the next question I have here is a pretty cool one. And she says, if there's only one God, why are there thousands of religions. It's commonly said that on earth, there's only one true religion. So if there is a God, why would he allow the creation of so many false faiths to distract us from this one path?
You know, I think that is a great question. I've thought about it many times. And one of the things that that I've thought about that is that it ties into the whole question, the broader question of if God's really a loving and all-powerful God, why does he allow bad things to happen to good people? And I don't know, that may be one of the other questions that you have on the docket. But God doesn't force us to believe in him. What I think has been demonstrated from the beginning is through a variety of ways, God has revealed himself to us. But he doesn't force us to believe. He gives us free will. And we can make up other explanations if we so choose. And we could ignore some things that are as plain as the nose on our face if we choose to. Another interesting insight from Lewis is that although God's given abundant information about his existence and about how we can have a relationship with him and how we can have eternal life, he hasn't given us 100% to where we could have no doubt. But it's because if he took away the possibility of any doubt and any free will and any doubt, let me rephrase that, it would be the same thing of taking away our free will. We would be mere robots. And so really all I know to say to that is I think it's a product of a God who is a God of love, who wants a personal relationship with us. And for a personal relationship to exist, for love to exist, there has to be free will to say no to him in terms of the way we live our lives or what we believe in response to what he's revealed to us. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not profound good evidence that God has revealed himself clearly and specifically through Christ and through the Bible. I think there is profound evidence for that. But it's not such that people can't come up with alternative explanations if they want to.
What do you think is the biggest threat to the Christian faith?
Well, interesting question. And by the way, let me just back up a second and add one thing. Heard a philosophy professor give a lecture on five reasons why somebody exploring truth about religion should begin with Christianity. And his first point was, it's testable. Gautama Buddha sits under a Bodhi tree and he gets enlightenment. There's no proof. There's no empirical proof whether the thoughts that he received are true. Muhammad is in a cave on multiple occasions, one man in a cave, and receives these revelations that even Muhammad himself wondered, were they from God or were they from Satan? But there's no offer of the ability to investigate certain truth claims based on empirical evidence. But in the case of Christianity, no less an authority than the Apostle Paul, says, if the resurrection of Jesus didn't happen, we're a bunch of fools. This isn't true. And so point one in this lecture was Christianity is investigatable. It takes place over time and space and history. And the central proof that Jesus offered to back up the extraordinary claims that he made was the resurrection. I listened to a wonderful podcast recently, an interview with probably the world's leading authority on the resurrection. His name is Gary Habermas. And in the midst of explaining what even critical scholars kind of surprisingly accept as historical facts surrounding the resurrection. He not only says that the best explanation of the facts that even the critical atheistic scholars accept, but he says, he makes this interesting statement, you can disbelieve the resurrection, but you can't disprove it. And just if anybody's interested, there's a podcast called Upstream on which you can find this interview with Dr. Habermas. So that's just a piece of it. The fact that there are a lot of different religions obviously creates tremendous confusion, but I don't believe God is the author of confusion, but he gives us free will. So, okay, now back to, remind me of the...
I'll go back to it in a second, but I want to go back to the Upstream podcast because I had never heard of it until yesterday. And ironically, I was having lunch with one of your disciples that you met with on a regular basis back in the early 80s.
I hope they're not my disciples. I hope they're his disciples.
Yes.
But yes, go ahead.
And back in the early 80s, you met with this guy once a week, and you discipled him is what I meant to say. And his name is Bo Glenn. So Bo and I had lunch yesterday, had a great conversation. You had a huge impact on him. And he mentioned this podcast called Upstream by a guy, what's his last name, Morrison or Morris?
The interviewer is Shane Morris.
Okay, Shane Morris.
They've got about six, it's a fairly new podcast. They've got about 60 episodes. And, you know, I've listened to probably 20 of them and some of them repeatedly. Some of them are really outstanding.
Awesome. I can't wait to check it out. Well, he sent me a screenshot of it. Like an old man, instead of sending me the actual link. So that's a rib at Bo, if you're listening. He screenshotted it. Thanks, man.
Bo's a great guy.
He is. Yeah, you can check out. I had a great interview with him last year, episode 5 or 6. I can't remember. So if you want to hear about him, he's awesome. So back to the question. Thank you for rewinding, though, because that was really valuable and helpful. My question was, what is the biggest threat to the Christian faith?
Wow. I would almost point us back to the original question that you asked about hypocrisy. And I would almost wonder if it's not people claiming to be followers of Christ who really aren't following him and representing him well, coming across rather as smug and holier than thou and inconsistent and not following his directions. And, you know, I think there are a lot of intellectual, very robust intellectual arguments for belief in God and belief that Christ really is God as he claimed to be. And yet, I wonder if, you know, there's an old saying, what you are speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you say. And so maybe if more of us who believe in Christ really followed his example and his teachings, that's perhaps what would have the greatest impact. And conversely, a failure to do that does the greatest damage.
So the Christian, basically, that is a holier-than-thou hypocrite, is the biggest threat. I'm with you. I mean, I think it...
I have to think about that question, that's what comes to me.
But it does come... I like it. I like that answer because it feels right to me because it's the... You know, because we all are hypocritical, obviously, in one respect or another, as much as we try to avoid it. And, you know, it was that very first question that I asked, man, you know, this guy's on his way to church flipping me the bird. Why would I want to become a Christian like that? I mean, that's a huge, huge turnoff to many people. I think it might be the number one turnoff to many of the people that I love dearly that don't want to have anything to do with it.
And so they don't even take a serious look at who Jesus is. They're turned off by the people that sadly give him a bad name.
Right. Right. Ironically, you know, though, you made a really good point, though. Ironically, it's the one that Jesus himself is most frustrated with and confronts so directly.
You know, there's I may not have it exactly right, the quote right, but the famous quote by Mahatma Gandhi, who made the statement, "I love their Christ, I don't love their Christians."
Fair statement.
And so, you know, I've talked to really agnostics and skeptics, and occasionally have been able to get some to actually read the firsthand accounts of Jesus and his life. And the interesting thing is that they're impressed when they actually meet the real Jesus, even though they were turned off by some of his representatives. So I think that would be a fair challenge, would be to encourage somebody who's turned off. Would you get to know the real Jesus rather than the caricature that has been made of him?
Mm. Yeah, well said. I mean, I find myself describing or just – I find myself divorcing – myself from religion and more towards relationship. And that seems, because it's the religion side that's outside of that one-on-one relationship that seems to sabotage in a way. So I have a off-the-wall question from one of my most off-the-wall buddies. And his question is, if intelligent life is discovered on another planet, would that change anything for you?
Wouldn't even make a blip. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that this is the only world God has created. I've just never seen how that has become an issue for somebody.
Yeah.
Now, I think that in spite of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence that's referred to as SETI, enormous expense and many years have been sought to try to find out if there's life anywhere else. I think the scientific evidence militates pretty strongly against that, just the odds.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't change anything for me in terms of my understanding of God. Why couldn't he have created other worlds? Is it possible, though, that he made the whole universe and fine-tuned everything for life on this planet? I think that's where the scientific evidence actually points. Somebody could do a Google search for, put in Eric Metaxas and PragerU.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a 5-minute piece that he has there, you just Google that, that shows the stunning odds, what's referred to as the fine-tuning of the universe for life. But if intelligent life is discovered somewhere else, fantastic. Glad to hear it.
So do you think that religion causes more conflict than it actually solves?
Well, you know, especially if you go back to what you just said a little bit earlier, there's a difference between religion and a personal relationship with God. And I think religion, which can refer to the rituals, the traditions, the public outcropping of it, I think can create some problems. But again, as we said before, somebody that really follows the example of Jesus and has that personal relationship with it doesn't make us perfect this side of heaven, but it does make a profound change. By the way, another great podcast on this Upstream is an interview with Tom Holland. He's a British historian. And for most of his life, quite a skeptic, identified with the Greeks and Romans and felt like all the noble values that he possessed, that's where he got them. Until he wrote a history of the Greeks and the Romans. He was horrified by what he saw and the cruelty and a complete disconnect with his values. Well, then that forced him to ask another question. Where did I get my values if I didn't get them from the Greeks and Romans, which is where I thought they came from? And his answer, he traced it to the Apostle Paul. And so what you find out from this skeptic, fascinating interview, is that there are profound implications to the degree that Christianity is lived out in a personal relationship with God, an attempt to really know Christ and follow him and his teachings. It has profoundly deep and positive effects in life. So that would be my response.
It's awesome. Well, so one of the things that I got a question from Bo, actually. He's the only one I'm going to reveal. This was his question, which I thought was really good, is over the last 45 years, you've just been in so many of these forums and have been in front of thousands of people with lots and lots of questions. Have you noticed the questions over the years, over four decades, evolving or changing?
That's a great question. And while there are nuances that change from decade to decade, maybe faster than that, early on in my search, I became aware of the fact that there were, I mentioned earlier, 10 to 12 big questions. I can rattle them off. Maybe I should. How do you know there's a God? Just because you believe in God, that doesn't mean that miracles make sense. How can an intelligent person who observes the laws of nature believe in miracles? And wait a minute, how do we know that the whole thing isn't just a psychological crutch? We've made this up. We wish it to be true that there's some kind of a God, that there's hope for the future, that there's something after we die. But how do we know we didn't just make it up? Freud wrote a book called The Future of an Illusion. So how do we know it's not just a psychological crutch? The next big one is, how do we know that the Bible is historically valid, first of all, but even if it is trustworthy as a historical record of what took place, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily inspired by God. How do you know that this is a trustworthy book? There are lots of religious books out there. What makes this special and unique and trustworthy? The next one is one I mentioned earlier about if there's a loving God, he wouldn't want suffering. If there's an all-powerful God, he should be able to do something about it. And yet, profound suffering exists and has existed throughout humanity. How could there be this all-loving and all-powerful God along with the existence of suffering and ultimately the ultimate suffering possibly of hell? How do you put those notions together? The next two, I think, have become more of an issue over these decades, but they've always been huge. And that is, every religion makes exclusive claims, but none more clear than the statement that Jesus made in different forms, but we find in John 14, where he says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. What do you mean, my Jewish, good atheist friend, Buddhist, Muslim, you mean this is so exclusive that they're not going to make it? How could that be true? And then a related question is, even if that were true for people who have access, what about people who were born at a time and a place they never had a chance to hear? Well, then the next one in the list is the one we've already talked about. Doesn't hypocrisy invalidate the claims that are being made? And then the next one is if you could have good reason to believe that there is a God and that he has trust and trustworthy way revealed to us about himself and his plan in the Bible. What is it? What does it take to get to heaven? First of all, how can we know that there is a life after death? And if there's a heaven and a hell, how do I get to the good place and avoid the bad place? And the sort of default assumption, not only by people from different religions, but oftentimes within Christendom, I find this common notion that, well, you get there by living a good life. And again, we touched on that earlier as well. The next one is, okay, isn't the Christian answer that we get this as a gift? Isn't that too easy? There's no such thing as a free lunch. We all know that. How could this be true? And if it's not our good deeds that qualify us, it's our faith. What does it mean to believe? Does it mean to commit intellectual suicide? What exactly is faith? And there's a great statement in one of the dialogues that we produced on this that faith isn't defined as a lack of doubting, but rather as a decision based on the evidence. So what is faith? How do you know you've done it? And then one of the last questions is, are you saying this is a gift? That if I accept this gift now, that I can be sure that I'm going to heaven when I die? Well, I think there are a lot of passages in the Bible that offer that assurance. And it's why it's called the good news. But then the question is, well, wait a minute. If that's true, what would be your motivation for living a good life? And after leading, you know, all these discussions and having so many conversations with people, about 20 years ago, a friend and I named Lamar Smith put together a series of audio dialogues called The Search for Meaning that it's a series of conversations on those very topics. And Lamar plays the role of the skeptic who's bringing up just one question after another, and we're kind of working through those. And the surprising thing that I've found is that in the decades, many decades that I began long ago, as I mentioned, wrestling through these questions, and then have had just countless conversations with people, those basic questions are still the same basic questions. And they're fair questions, they're honest questions, and they deserve honest responses.
Awesome. Well, that's I got many of those questions, and obviously we don't have the ability to go through all those, but we will link in our show notes the podcast that you mentioned with was it Lamar Smith? You said?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's called The Search for Meaning.
The Search for Meaning. And I've listened to it before. I listened to it back in the day when it was a cassette tape.
Yeah.
A series of them. It was even before CDs. So
nobody has a place to play a CD.
Yeah, it's true. And now you had to make it a podcast.
And by the way, the advantage of that is you didn't always have a place to play a CD, but we've got our phones with us pretty much 24/7.
I know it. It's the truth. Well,
pretty convenient.
I want to end. We're running out of time, and I want to end our time here with some fun rapid fire questions that are a little bit lighter weight. So, what is the biggest thief of your time?
What is the biggest thief of my time? Wow, got to stop and think about that. It's a great question. I don't have a good answer. I'm going to have to think about that. I work pretty hard about being intentional with my time, and I guess everybody does, but every day I want to finish the end of the day with a sense of my day was purposeful and meaningful. And so,
well, you've had a lot of practice, Bill.
I'm sure there are time wasters that I'm absolutely guilty of.
Yeah.
You know, we've all got access to too many news feeds and too many distractions. So as I'm thinking about it a little bit, I have to be careful with how much of that I allow to take my time.
Well, that leads me to the next question, which is how do you consume the news?
Get a couple regular feeds that address current events.
Which are what are they specifically? I'm curious because I
well, there's a Monday through Friday email, and I think it's called the Daily Article. A guy named Dr. Jim Dennison, somebody put me onto this a couple of years ago, and he takes the day's news and pulls out some key events that are going on and filters them through a very good biblical perspective. So that and just, you know, news feeds that I get on my phone or computer, just try to stay aware of what's going on, but not submerged by it.
Not submerged by it. Well, I'm currently doing this little experiment personally because I've largely ignored the news for 20 years and have gotten my news from friends. So I sent an email out to some of my closer buddies and just said, hey, I haven't read the news in 20 years. I'm going to send you an email once a week commenting on what I'm seeing. And I'm struggling to find good news sources. I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, and then I just subscribe to the Startlegram and Star Telegram, and then subscribe to the Business Press, the Fort Worth Business Press, just to get some local flavor in there. And anyway, it's been an interesting journey because I'm gonna probably unsubscribe from things if it causes more anxiety for me or causes me to get stressed out or causes the vein on my forehead to pop out throughout the day. So I'm going to try to temper at what level I go into this vortex of news. But I'm finding it difficult to find the truth in there, actually. And I do read Dennison's email. I do get that one, which I appreciate. It's a good angle, but it just seems to be slanted heavily one way or the other from what I'm seeing so far. So it's just interesting.
Are you talking about Dennison's in particular?
No, I'm just talking about. I mean, if you wanted to,
because I think he works pretty hard at staying neutral politically, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I would say that he does. I'm talking more about, you know, if you were going to read the Washington Post or the New York Times versus other stuff. It just seems to be leaned one way or the other, and it's hard to settle on what's real and what's agenda for me. So I'm just anyway. It's been a heck of an experiment. But
I think the news media has lost a tremendous amount of public trust, and particularly so in the last decade.
Yeah, for sure in the last decade. What does the first hour of your day look like? Feel free to be specific.
Just get ready to head off to my first meeting, but real important to at the beginning of the day before all the distractions hit to have some personal me time with God. That's prayer. That's reading the Bible, asking God for insight, praying for the people I love, praying for concerns that I have in my life. So that, you know, there's that old deal about the guy who's got a jar, and this is a demonstration in front of a class, and he's got some rocks, and he's got some sand, and he's got a couple cans of beer, and he's got some pebbles, and he asks the class, do you think I can get all these in the jar? And it's clear that that's way too much volume and it's not going to fit in the jar. And so he does a little demonstration. He says it makes an enormous amount of difference, the order in which you put those in the jar. Put the rocks in first then the pebbles, and you shake it a little bit, and the pebbles drop. Then the sand, shake it a little bit, and then there's always time for a couple beers, as he says. So it's kind of like, what are we going to put in first?
Yeah.
And so that's a challenge to me because mm-hmm. I'm so personally action-oriented. I want to get off to that first meeting, and I've got A, B, and C to do, and want to be busy, want to be productive, and it's personally a challenge to me, but extremely important. First things first.
Well, my last question is, how many years have you been married to Janet?
This August, it was 52 years.
52 years. Okay. So
we were babies when we got married.
Yeah.
We did kind of grow up together. We were very young. And
is there anything, a lot of my listeners are in their early 30s, and just sort of getting going, have young kids and getting going in business. And do you have any words of wisdom? You've been married a long dang time, Bill. You must have some words of wisdom for these guys listening.
You know, over the years, I've ended up doing quite a bit of premarital counseling and some marital counseling. I don't hang out a shingle for it. I'm not looking for it. It's just, you know, in some cases, maybe I'm the only person that somebody knows that they're willing to open up to a little bit. And this is one of the enormous practical benefits of at least the extent to which I choose to follow the principles that are in the Bible about how to live life and how to do marriage. And it's revolutionary. Now, I'll be the first to tell you that I fail to measure up to those principles and those commandments. But the degree to which that I am willing to follow those and ask God's help to follow them, to me, that is absolutely the key. And I have shared some of these principles with people whose marriages were dead and over. And the extent to which they were willing to figure out, what is it I think God wants me to be? What is it I think he wants me to do? And were willing to do that? I've just observed some radical changes. Or a lot of great books, by the way. A lot of them. I had heard of one some time ago, but finally got it. And it may now be at the top of my list. I'm only halfway through it, but it's called The Meaning of Marriage by Tim Keller. And I would just say, get that book.
Yeah, that's a good
one. You want some help, you want some perspective, mm-hmm. want some honest explanation of what are the dynamics in a relationship, what's this all about, why do it God's way, really, really insightful. So rather than giving you a list of principles, I'll say from what I've seen so far, there's a tremendous source, a lot of enrichment there.
Awesome. Well, that's a great recommendation. We'll link it also in the show notes as well. Well, we're out of time, Bill. This has been so fun and helpful and inspiring, and I think we really just scraped the surface really of some of these really important questions. And you know, if you want to know more and hear more from Bill, what's the URL, Bill, to your website where people can?
Well, for the search for meaning, it's just the search, www.thesearchformeaning.org. Do you want me to give my email address?
Oh, I can, if you want to, sure.
Well, is that what you were asking for?
Well, I was just asking how people get a hold of you. So it just, was wanting to, and they can do that through the website pretty easily, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's B Craftson, BKRAFTSON at searchnational.org.
Awesome. Well, do you have any parting thoughts before we go, Bill?
No, you've asked some great questions. You're a good interviewer. Now maybe I'll listen to some of your other podcasts.
Yeah, there's some good ones in there for sure. Well, I appreciate your time, Bill, and God bless.
It's been a pleasure. You're welcome.
Well, folks, that wraps up our show for this week. do me a favor and type in truegritpodcast.com and subscribe to the True Grit blog. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you will get a super short nugget that will help you become a better leader. Included in these posts, you will also get the show notes with links to books, articles, and other cool things discussed on the show. Thanks, as always, for listening to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place.